since 1811, the U.S. government has had something called the Conscience Fund. And they have received hundreds of thousands of letters of people trying to free their conscience of the failures of their past, the mistakes, the decisions that have caught them and led them to be bound up within their minds. $3.5 million since 1811 has been given to this Conscience Fund. Letter after letter after letter. Some of the letters, as we read them, may be quite humorous, if not for the fact that many of us, even sitting in this room, feel that same trauma of wanting to be free from our failures. Failures arrive in our hands as small pebbles, marking a decision that we've made, and as the years go by, as the decisions carry on, more and more pebbles get into our hands. Eventually, those pebbles get too full for our hands, too big, and they start to spill over, and so we put them into our pockets. And as the years go by, they start to spill out of our pockets, so we put them into a satchel on our back. And as the years go by, that becomes so heavy, we have to take it off of our back and we have to drag it along the floor. And as it gets even heavier, sometimes we stop because of the weight of it. This is not a story that you are exempt from. It is a story that we know that many of you in this room, and certainly if not you, your friends, your family, your colleagues battle from. They do not know what to do with their failures. You see, since the beginning of time, since sin entered this world, failure has been fatal. We may be sitting here, breathing, living beings, but there may be parts of us that have died a long time ago because of our failures, because of decisions that we've made. We may be sitting here having accepted Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior, but He hasn't yet brought revival. We sing that song earlier of Lord revival. Bring your revival. Would you revive it now? Would your spirit come and do that work? There are parts of us, even though our trust is in Jesus, that has not yet found the redeeming and reviving hand of Jesus Christ. And there are parts of us that are dead and dying because of failures, mistakes, our past. In the case of this ex-GI, as he signed it off from 30 years prior. For many of us, it was yesterday. But somewhere in that narrative, we need to understand how to process our failures, how to process the trauma of our past, decisions that we've made that have caused us, in some instances, to be limping, and in others, to have stopped dead on the road. What do we do with our failures? We're in a series called 6 Hours, One Friday, speaking about the cross and the time that Jesus spent on it that we get to celebrate this coming Friday. 6 Hours, One Friday. What did Jesus accomplish for us on the cross? And there are a couple of offers that He made while He was there. And there are a couple of things, a couple of victories that He won for us. And last week, we looked at this, that our life is not futile. Again, from the very beginning, one of Cain's punishments after he killed Abel was that he was sent out and he became a restless wanderer in the earth. And these were his words, "My burden is too much for me to bear." Too many people live purposeless lives, and that is the work of sin and the enemy and our failings of the past. Yet Jesus offers something different. From the beginning of time, people have been wrestling with the futility of their lives. What does it count for? The offer from Jesus is your life is not futile. He also offers us this, that our failures don't have to be fatal. Our failures don't have to be fatal. And we're going to be talking about that today. And the coming weekend, we're going to be talking about this, that death is not final. 6 Hours, One Friday, what did Jesus truly win for us? What did He win for us? You see, there were many things that Jesus did while He was on this earth. Jesus prayed, Jesus taught, Jesus healed, Jesus laughed, He wept. None of those things were His chief purpose or His aim. We read what it is in Mark chapter 10, verse 45. "The Son of Man did not come to be served. He came to serve others and give His life as a ransom for many people." And as though that's not enough, another one of the gospel writers just goes on to affirm it and confirm it, because we need convincing sometimes of why Jesus did what He did. And it says in Luke chapter 19, verse 9, the Son of Man came to find lost people and save them. 6 hours, one Friday. What do we do with Jesus on the cross? This is what he came to give us. He came to save lost people. Those things that the enemy have stolen from us. That which has been lost in our God-created image and yet sin coming in and robbed from us. That's what he came to do, to ransom his life for us. He came to exchange his life for ours. 6 hours, one Friday. And today, your failures do not have to be fatal. And I'm going to be using three scriptures, three stories out of the scriptures, which I believe prove God's heart towards us and give us three offers. And maybe in your imagination, as you listen to me, you can picture Jesus on the cross. And as you ask him this question, why did you do that? What did you do? Why? What were you offering us? As you listen to each of these offers, can you hear the words of Jesus as he answers your question, why are you on that cross and not me? Listen to the offers. And the invitation today is that you would appropriate them for your own life. What will you do with the 6 hours, one Friday, that Jesus spent on the cross? Your failures do not have to be fatal. The first offer that we look at is this. An offer of no condemnation. A couple of years ago, well, more than a couple of years ago, when we just had two girls, and they can have been no more than 2 and 4 years old. There was one afternoon, I remember clearly we lived in Curry Road. I think the name has changed of Curry Road. I don't know what it's changed to. But as Jax and I had finished our afternoon sleep, we walked into our girls' room. And as we walked into the room, Picasso had been there. And we saw crayon, incredible expression, given a liberal surface area to what was inside the inventive minds of two little girls. And the girls, as they swung around with big smiles on their faces to see the masterwork they had put onto their wall, I think they very quickly realized that mom and dad were not equally sharing in their joy. And in that moment, there was this decision of, okay, is this a failure? Was this not a hugely successful decision that we made as a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old to put crayon all over the wall? And Jax and I, in the best way that we knew how to parent, we pulled our girls up onto our laps, and I was able to ask Kiara at that point in time and just say, Kiara, what happened last time? What did Daddy do last time you drew all over the walls? And then she suddenly thought about it and remembered. She goes, Daddy, we got a spank last time. So I'm like, okay, so what do you think Daddy should do this time that you have done the same thing? She goes, with a big smile on her face, and some of you that know Kiara can picture the scene, love us. Love us. And the truth of the matter is that's the story that we all want. We all want the story of a father that though our failures are painted up on a wall, we would not receive the condemnation due us, but that we would receive the love of a father who would look over our mistakes and our failures. In Brazil, in Rio de Janeiro, many of you may know this, and some of you may have even had the privilege of seeing it in person, but there is this massive statue that is 2.4 kilometers above sea level, overlooking Rio, and it's known as the Cristo Redentor, which is the Christ the Redeemer. It's a 27.5-meter statue that is 1,300 tons of Brazilian stone. This is the statue. Many of us will know it if we've seen pictures and images of it as it looks over and looks out over Rio. But there's two startling things about it. If you go and have a look at a picture, don't Google it right now. Google it after I've finished my message. But if you go and have a look at it, it's as though the sculptor deliberately did not give eyes to Christ the Redeemer. There are no eyes. There's no circle. There's no pupil to even indicate that this Christ the Redeemer can see or has vision. And again, the original argument or your argument may be, well, no statue can see. But this is even, it's even taken a step further that there's not even an attempt to see, not even an attempt to have a pupil or an iris within the statue. And then as you come down from the eyes a little bit, it moves on and it comes over to the breast, and there's a heart that has been carved out of the stone. Just a very simple heart. Very stony. Just cut out of 1,300 tons of stone. And it's this Christ the Redeemer standing 2.4 kilometers at a distance above Rio. 7 million people below this statue. But a statue that is unable to see and has a cold heart. Very unlike Christ the Redeemer that we know from the scriptures. Very unlike Christ the Redeemer that we've come to know in person. And yet too often, it is the Christ the Redeemer that some of you may have a picture of in your mind, or certainly your friends and colleagues and family have. See, many of us view Jesus as 2.5 kilometers off, with no eyes to see what's going on in our lives, distant, with no heart of compassion to care for what we've done. We have to carry around our satchel of failures, sometimes coming to a standstill, and we've got no one to help us. I want to tell you that the offer of no condemnation stands today with Jesus. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a story to us that's written by a man called Max Licardo. This series comes out of a book that he wrote called 6 Hours, One Friday. I encourage you to read it. He has a brilliant storyteller, the ability to take the truths of Scripture and capture them. But I'm going to read us a story, because as much as I would love to think that I can tell the story in grandeur and all of that, he just does it so much better than I could possibly do it. And so I know that for many of you, I'm going to take you back to your school days now and read you a story. I know that for many of you, that was a very long time ago. But I want you to listen to this story. I want you to embrace this story. If that means closing your eyes, please feel free to do that, unless you went to bed really late last night. I don't want you falling asleep. But embrace the story, and I'd like you to listen to it with this lens, as I said a little bit earlier. This is not just a message for those that do not know Jesus. I think even more so, this is a message for those that do know Jesus and yet still feel like he is far off, has a stony heart and no eyes to see, and you still live under the condemnation of failures past. Could you listen to the story through that lens? It's dawn. The early morning sun stretches a golden blanket across the streets of the city. Diamonds of dew cling to blades of grass. A cat stretches as it awakens. The noises are scattered. A rooster crows his early morning recital. A dog barks to welcome the day. A peddler shuffles down the street, his wares on his back. And a young carpenter speaks in the courtyard. Jesus sits surrounded by a horseshoe of listeners. Some nod their heads in agreement and open their hearts in obedience. They have accepted the teacher as their teacher and are learning to accept him as their Lord. Others are curious, wanting to believe, yet wary of this one whose claims so stretch the boundaries of belief. Whether cautious or convinced, they listen keenly. They arose early. There was something about his words that was more comforting than sleep. We don't know his topic that morning, prayer perhaps, or maybe kindness or anxiety. But whatever it was soon interrupted when people burst into the courtyard. Determined, they erupt out of a narrow street and stomp toward Jesus. The listeners scramble to get out of the way. A mob is made up of religious leaders, the elders and the deacons of their day, respected and important men. And struggling to keep her balance on the crest of this angry wave is a scantily clad woman. Only moments before, she had been in bed with a man who was not her husband. Was this how she made her living? Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe her husband was gone, her heart was lonely, and the stranger's touch was warm, and before she knew it, she had done it. We don't know. But we do know that the door was jerked open, and she was yanked from a bed. She barely had time to cover her body before she was dragged into the street by 2 men the age of her father. What thoughts raced through her mind as she scrambled to keep her feet? Curious neighbors stuck heads through open windows. Sleepy dogs yelped at the ruckus, and now with holy strides, the mob storms towards the teacher. They throw the woman in his direction. She nearly falls. "We found this woman in bed with a man," cries the leader, "and the law says to stone her. What do you say?" Cocky with borrowed courage, they smirk as they watch the mouse go for the cheese. The woman searches the faces, hungry for a compassionate glance. She finds none. Instead, she sees accusation, squinty eyes, tight lips, gritted teeth, stares, that sentence without seeing, cold, stony hearts that condemn without feeling. She looks down and sees the rocks in their hands, the rocks of righteousness intended to stone the lust right out of her. The men squeeze them so tightly that their fingertips are white. They squeeze them as if the rocks were the throat of the preacher that they hate. In her despair, she looks at the teacher. His eyes don't glare. "Don't worry," they whisper. "It's okay." And for the first time that morning, she sees kindness. When Jesus saw her, what did he see? Did he see her as a father sees his grown daughter as she walks down the wedding aisle? The father's mind races back through time, watching this girl grow up again, from diapers to dolls, from classrooms to boyfriends, from the matric dance to the wedding day. The father sees it all as he looks at his daughter. As Jesus looked at his daughter, did his mind race back? Did he relive the act of forming this child in heaven? Did he see her as he had originally made her? Knitted together is how the psalmist described the process of God making man. Not manufactured or mass-produced, but knitted, each thread of personality tenderly intertwined. Each string of temperament deliberately selected. God as creator, pensive, excited, inventive. The creator, the master weaver, threading together the soul. Each one different, no two alike, none identical. On earth, Jesus was an artist in a gallery of his own paintings, and yet his works of art had been defaced, creation after battered creation. He had created people for splendor, they had settled for mediocrity. He had formed them with love, they had scarred each other with hate. When he saw businessmen using God-given intelligence to feed Satan-given greed, when he saw tongues he had designed to encourage use as daggers to cut, when he saw hands that had been given for holding used as weapons for hurting, when he saw eyes into which he had sprinkled joy now burning with hatred, I wonder, did it weary him to see hearts that were strained, even discarded? Jesus saw such a heart as he looked at this woman. Her feet were bare and muddy, her arms hid her chest, and her hands clutched each other under her chin. And her heart was ragged, torn as much by her own guilt as by the mob's anger. And so with the tenderness only a father can have, he set out to untie the knots and repair the holes. He begins by diverting the crowd's attention. He draws on the ground and everybody looks down. The woman feels relief as the eyes of the men look away from her. The accusers are persistent. "Tell us, teacher, what do you want us to do with her?" He could have asked why they didn't bring the man. The law indicted him as well. He could have asked why they were suddenly blowing the dust off an old command that had sat on the shelves for centuries, but he didn't. He just raised his head and offered an invitation. "I guess if you've never made a mistake, then you have a right to stone this woman." He looked back down and began to draw on the earth again. Someone cleared his throat as if to speak, but no one spoke. Feet shuffled, eyes dropped, and then thud, 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 the rocks fell to the ground, and they walked away. Beginning with the grayest beard and ending with the blackest, they turned and left. They came as one, and they left one by one. Jesus told the woman to look up. "Is there no one to condemn you?" He smiled as she raised her head. She saw no one, only rocks, each one a miniature tombstone to mark the burial place of a man's arrogance. "Is there no one to condemn you?" he had asked. "There is still one who can," she thinks. And she turns to look at him. What does he want? What will he do? Maybe she expected him to scold her. Perhaps she expected him to walk away from her. I'm not sure, but I do know this. What she got, she never expected. She got a promise and a commission. The promise, "Then neither do I condemn you." The commission, "Go and sin no more." The woman turns and walks into anonymity. She's never seen or heard from again. But we can be confident of one thing. On that morning in Jerusalem, she saw Jesus and Jesus saw her. And could we somehow transport her to Rio de Janeiro and let her stand at the base of the Cristo Redentor? I know what her response would be. "That's not the Jesus I saw. She would be right, for the Jesus she saw didn't have a hard heart. The Jesus she saw didn't have blind eyes. Story over. 6 hours, one Friday, the cross of Jesus Christ, he came to ransom the lost. He came to serve. The offer that he makes today for our failures is this: there is no more condemnation. No more condemnation. What will you do with that offer as you carry around your bag of stones, of failures that have caused you to limp, stumble, and possibly come to a standstill in the path that is our life? Offer number two, he offers outstretched arms. Outstretched arms. There's this beautiful story in Luke chapter 15, verses 11 to 24. And the story goes like this. There is a young man, one of two brothers, and he gets a little bit selfish. He's lived his life around his own basis, and he comes to his dad, and he says this. He says, "Dad, give me my inheritance now." See, here is a son who is more interested in what his father has to offer him as an inheritance than the father himself. More interested in the money that he can get than the dad that brought him into the world. I pause for effect so that we may just think that one through. And as this young man goes away, it says in the scriptures that he squandered all of his wealth on wild living. Some of us in this room may have that story as our own story. How do we deal with the decisions, the mistakes, the failures, the sin of our past? He gets so desperate, he has no food on his table, that he sells himself to a pig farmer. And he starts feeding the pigs, and he has this moment of reckoning that he doesn't even eat as well as the pigs are eating. And it says in the word that he longed just to eat what the pigs were eating. A moment of reckoning, a moment where he has a decision to make, where he can take hold of his failures and he can say, "Actually, I have a good father at home." Or he can continue to put up his mask, go back to that the one who is serving, and develop calluses over his heart and his mind. Too often we become so good at disguising ourselves. But there's a moment of reckoning. There's a moment that this son, who has squandered his wealth, squandered his father's generosity, squandered the family name, and he says, "I'm actually going to go back to my father and hope that he receives me." And he starts to practice this message. And he says this in his mind: "I'm going to tell him, Dad, I have sinned against heaven and I have sinned against you." And he starts walking home, and every step, he's going through the story in his mind. "I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. What is my dad going to do? Is he going to cast me out? Is he going to spank me? Is he going to hold up my failures before me? What is he going to do?" And yet, actually, that option is a better option than continuing to live with the mask, continuing to be fed with the pigs, continuing to live in the dirt of a broken life. And he comes back, and we read in the scriptures this moment where he sees his father. Verse 17. Verse 19, he says, "I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants." And so he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his sons, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." Check what the father does here. He's like almost ignoring what the son is saying. And he says, the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for the son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." And so they began to celebrate. 6 hours, one Friday, Jesus on the cross, there is an offer which says the Father has outstretched arms. What will we do with that, friends? Will we continue to live in the muck and the mire of our failures, of our decisions, continuing to grow harder and harder hearts, or will we turn to the Father? See, the image that Jesus is trying to portray in this story is that the Father's arms are outstretched, and we don't know if Jesus, while he was telling the story, had his arms outstretched. What we do know is just a few days later, he was so adamant that the Father's arms are outstretched that Jesus modeled it by getting his hands nailed to a cross permanently open. 6 hours, one Friday, Jesus offers no condemnation. Jesus offers a Father with open arms. Regardless of your failures and your mistakes, that's what Jesus won on the cross. What will we do with that? The third thing we see Jesus offer is that we can be in paradise with him. There's a story that we read of in Luke chapter 23, verses 32 to 43, and it's a story of Jesus' death, the 6 hours, one Friday. And Luke records that there are two men on either side of Jesus who have become the scum of that town, the scum of Jerusalem. They had become the lowest of life. They had made mistake, after decision, after failure, after failure, after sin, after sin. They were thieves and robbers. And the first one got a fine. Then the next time they stole, they ended up in prison. They served their sentence. They got released. The next time they served the longer sentence, they got out. They got released. The purpose of prison is to rehabilitate, but these men could never be rehabilitated, and so they were sentenced to execution. Only the worst of the worst got executed on a cross, and there are two men on either side of Jesus, we read in this account. And what's happening is the soldiers are busy mocking Jesus and saying, if you are the Son of God, then bring yourself down from that cross, save yourself. And one of the robbers says, turns to him and starts picking up on the back end of what all the crowd are saying. And he says, yes, God, Jesus, if you are the Son of God, then save yourself. And while you're at it, save us too. Just selfishly viewing this. And the other robber has a moment. And he says this to the man too, to his left, Jesus. And this other man who had made failure after failure, decision after decision, that had led to him becoming stuck in life, and his failures had become fatal. And he said, don't you fear God? Don't you fear God? One of the most beautiful moments in all of Scripture. A man sentenced to death for his sin, for the way that he had treated community, the way he had treated other people. This man stands up to defend Jesus. And in this moment, he ignores the crowd, he ignores everything. He's had this revelation as he realizes, and he says this, don't you fear God? This man, he says, we are dying. We are here getting what we deserve for our actions. This man is getting what he does not deserve for his actions. And then he says this, Jesus, will you remember me? Will you remember me when you come into your Father's kingdom? And there's this incredible moment. And Jesus looks at him again, silencing the crowd, the robber that's hurling insults. And he has this moment, eye to eye, compassionate heart to compassionate heart, in the midst of the 6 hours, one Friday. Jesus, till the very last breath, had eyes to see and a heart of compassion to care for people. And he says, today you will be with me in paradise. This man just asked for the crumbs from the Father's table. Instead, he got to be with Jesus in paradise. This is the offer that Jesus makes to us today. The offer of the 6 hours, one Friday, is that you can live free from condemnation. The offer of the 6 hours, one Friday, is that you have a Father with outstretched arms. And the offer of the 6 hours, one Friday, is that you can be in paradise with him. What will you do with the offer that Jesus puts before you of 6 hours, one Friday? See, friends, Jesus' time on that cross in those 6 hours, the most significant 6 hours of all of history, where he was able to turn our life around from futility to purpose. Those 6 hours where he was able to turn around the fatality of our failures into life. And those 6 hours where he was able to triumph over death, which means our death is not final. This is the offer of the cross. This is the offer of Easter. This is the story that you and I get to live in, are invited in. Would you allow the Spirit of God to get into those parts of your life, those failures of the past, where you're still carrying around those stones? And will you allow the Spirit of God to massage the truth of what Jesus accomplished on the cross, so that you may be set free, that you may come into more fullness of life as Jesus intended it, so that you too can help lead others to life? The story of the cross. Would you stand with me?